biome is not like a blueprint in that it's not static. So that's one key concept, is that the microbiome and what the microbiome does may be constantly shifting. That's what is so beautiful about it, but also so complex at the same time, because you can't just say, okay, I did a microbiome test and the microbiome says this, and therefore this is how I'm going to eat for the rest of my life. And then it probably doesn't work that way.
Dr. Marvin Singh. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. How's it going?
It's going well. And I got to tell you, I feel so honored and privileged to have you on the show today. And thank you for your willingness out on the West Coast to get up at such an early hour. I'm a morning guy myself. And so to have a fellow traveler who's willing to do this sort of thing this early, I really appreciate it.
No problem. The pleasure's all mine.
Okay, so let's just dive in really quickly. Obviously, I will give a full bio, but in the show notes as well as the intro to the show, which is quite extensive with you. What I would like you to do, though, just to kind of kick things off for the audience, let them know how your practice works. Because you do have somewhat of a multifaceted practice, which I think is really cool. And I want to talk a little bit about that. So just tell people who you are, what your practice is like, and then kind of why you've taken this total wellness approach to medicine that you have.
I am an integrative gastroenterologist, which means I have been board certified in internal medicine, gastroenterology, and integrative medicine. I did a formal 2-year training program under Andrew Weil at the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine. And all of these background educational programs I went through kind of helped me become who I am today. I don't know if I would have realized how important the gut was and the microbiome was if I wasn't an actual gut expert, a gastroenterologist first. I think there's a key difference in actually being a gut guy in real life and saying that you know about the gut. I guess it's a little different when you're inside of a colon every day. After this, I'm gonna go do some colonoscopy. So, one of the areas that I developed a particular interest in was precision medicine. I became very interested in the microbiome, in genetics, nutritional genetics, that's how I started. I did some of these kinds of tests on myself. I tested out different companies and tried to figure out which ones I liked the best, which ones looked like they had the most science behind them. And I started applying some of these concepts in the results to my own health. This was several years ago, and I used that information and combined it with the principles of integrative medicine that I had learned in fellowship training. And I actually started to see some magic happening in my own body. I was losing weight. I didn't have heartburn anymore. I had more energy. I was more motivated to exercise and to meditate and to do all those other things. And then incrementally, all of those benefits started adding up as well. And I became a different person. And that really made me very passionate about precision medicine. And I started applying these same concepts to my own patients and started seeing the same things happening as well. And so I really came to feel that precision medicine was a game changer in how we really define health or what it means to be healthy, and that everybody is not the same. And without understanding what's going on in each individual person, it's hard to really kind of pinpoint which direction to go sometimes.
Okay, that is fantastic. That's exactly where I want to start. Because, okay, so let me back up a little bit and tell you something that I did not tell you offline about my background is I have a daughter that has type 1 diabetes. And so there's nothing that will make you start to at least consider and better understand precision healthcare, and diet, everything, than like having a diabetic as a child. And so, because all of a sudden now you're counting calories, you're watching when you eat, what you eat. And then from that, and fortunately, and I'd like for you to touch a little bit on this, I can't imagine we wouldn't cover it at some point. Fortunately, she and I both had adopted intermittent fasting before, or right around the time she was diagnosed, which has been helpful as far, again, looking at the timing and the precision of what we eat. So understanding that, okay, and she has a certain circumstance that requires her to watch what she eats, when she eats it, based on and her glucose levels, which are not the same for just because you are a 20-year-old with type 1 diabetes, your glucose levels at this time of day are going to be the same. You can't generalize, right? It's the same thing that I've recently learned with the gut, that there is a blueprint, like our DNA, that is our gut unique to us. So tell the audience, as we get into this, because you mentioned precision a number of times, if they are going to start adopting a precisioned approach to mapping their own your gut biome, their diet that is used, that is unique to them, and how foods react, which some people are just lucky, right? I mean, some as far as the weight gain and how their glucose spikes, what makes your glucose shoot through the roof may have little to no effect on me. Talk to the audience about how to start that process, what to look for, and for me, like I told you, I'm a novice. I want to get really, really precise with what I eat, when I eat, for all the reasons you mentioned. Where do I start?
Well, I guess we should clarify one thing. Our DNA is like a blueprint in that your DNA is not going to change.
Right.
Until we develop gene therapy where we can actually change it. But that's a whole other topic in
sure
and of
thing.
Itself.
Yeah, right.
Our microbiome is not like a blueprint in that it's not static. So that's one key concept, is that the microbiome and what the microbiome does may be constantly shifting.
Yeah.
That's what is so beautiful about it, but also so complex at the same time,
right?
Because you can't just say, okay, I did a microbiome test and the microbiome says this, and therefore this is how I'm going to eat for the rest of my life. And then it probably doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
There are some key concepts that are probably universal when we're talking about the microbiome. Maybe we can talk about some of that too, if you like, as we go along.
Yeah.
And some basic principles and some things that we're looking for when we're looking at the microbiome. But I think it's important to understand that we may need to periodically check in on the microbiome. It's not something that you check once and then go from there. Your genes are never going to change. So you could do a genetic test and do it once, and that's the end of the story, because the test that is never going to change unless the understanding around the genes and what they do changes. That would be the only thing that might change. And knowledge always changes. So, you know, that's also possible as well. But, you know, what I would do when, you know, if somebody wants to get a personalized approach to eating, as you were asking, how do we get started? You know, sometimes the simplest way is to do a basic nutritional genetics panel. That's a test that will give you an idea of what your genetic risks might be for certain things that pertain to nutrition, like genetic risk for vitamin D deficiency or gluten intolerance or not being able to drink too much caffeine because it might give you a heart attack, or not eating too much salt because that might increase your risk of hypertension. So there are different kinds of genes like that where that you can check. On a more personal level, what your risks are for certain things, so you can modify your eating behavior according to that. And then looking at the microbiome and seeing how diverse it is, what functions are being performed, how well its digestive efficiency is, and things like that might help you understand as well what kinds of foods and things you want to include in your diet so that you can encourage the growth of the good microbes. And it's that word diversity that we need to be aware of, not just for our microbiomes, but actually in real life, you know, as human beings. It's a very key concept. Diversity is important. There's no way to get around it. And, you know, The more diverse a microbiome you have, the more different kinds of functions those microbes can do. And the more functions that you can do, the better off you are. We want, you know, just like in the workforce, we want a bunch of different people with many different backgrounds who can perform many different functions, because that will make us have a more diverse workforce that can accomplish new things, that can innovate, and that can deal with a problem, that if a problem comes up. And so that concept that you might apply in the workforce actually applies to the workforce in your gastrointestinal tract. You know, and then sometimes we'll look at, you know, the first important thing is actually to learn what behavior somebody has around particular foods, because there may be some issues there that in the conversation you might be able to figure out what they should and shouldn't be eating. And then sometimes we may do a food sensitivity panel or something as well, that, you know, that's not a perfect science, but it may help guide some of the understanding around how to do an elimination diet if there's some particular food sensitivities and things like that.
And what would you do on that, Dr. Singh? Like just a continuous glucose monitor, or would you just do like a prick, or how are these tests conducted?
Those are blood tests. So, okay. You know, that's a blood test. Some of them are finger prick blood tests, and some of them are actually blood draws. Okay. And, you know, they're not a perfect science, but sometimes they can be quite helpful in guiding. And so now we're looking at an immune component. We're looking at a genetic component. We're looking at a microbiome component. And those are pretty, you know, some good basic places to start as far as what kinds of tests you can do. And then looking at all those things together can help you understand how you should eat. So that's kind of how you might get started.
Okay. And then there's two approaches that really fascinate me on this. One that you mentioned, that you can just realize based on your genetic makeup, certain foods and things that you might be sensitive to, or some setbacks you may be prone to if you don't, you know, manipulate your diet and your nutritional intake. But also there's this idea of longevity, which I think is incredibly important. You know, one of the things I'm really interested in right now is, you know, Dr. Peter Attia's work, I think from an MD standpoint, and then more of an academic standpoint, the work that David Sinclair's doing. And the thing I like that David Sinclair has done, which I find a lot of your work to line up with, is treating longevity and or aging as more of how we would treat a disease, as you know, it's preventive, as opposed to just, well, you're old, so now you have to do these things. Instead, we can actually do these things along the way. So when it comes to the panels, the testing, and understanding nutritionally what we're eating, and please feel free to fill in the, like what you mentioned earlier, the mindfulness, because there's so much which I didn't know. I don't want to sound like I've got this all figured out, because I certainly don't. But one of the things I'm learning, and I'm ever fascinated by, is the connection of the neurotransmitters in the gut that are impacted by diet, that do impact the cognitive health of an individual, like you said, and how that ties to meditation and mood and those sorts of things. So tell me, from an aging standpoint, how often should we be looking internally, doing the panels, doing the testing, making sure, because I'm 46. I want to be 46 going on 26. I want to stop. I want to do the Benjamin Button deal. You know, I want to keep this thing at least slow this process as much as possible. And so at 46, what, you know, I want to know along the process, how often do I need to be looking at these things and looking for the levers to pull? I mean, what do you suggest? I know I just blasted a lot there, but just kind of take that where you will, philosophically, medically, however you want to tackle it.
Yeah, these are good questions. It's a lot of different topics, so we'll try to touch on all of them. I think it's very important to understand what's going on inside your body, the sooner the better, right? You know, there are certain things that obviously don't apply to younger people. Like, it wouldn't make as much sense unless there was some unusual genetic issue that would require it to do a CT coronary calcium score on a 20-year-old. I mean, that seems like a bit much, you know.
Right.
Or even whole body imaging. But you know, as we age, these are some of the things that come up, because as we age, our risks for certain things may occur more so than when we were younger. But that doesn't mean that we can't work towards being that younger version of yourself all the time. Yeah. The earlier, the better. The more you know, the better. Even, you know, you're like we said, your genes aren't going to change. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you knew, you know, at your age that you might have a genetic predisposition for, you know, heart disease or even Alzheimer's disease. And we know that there are certain things that we can do to modify that risk. Why would you not? You know, it's like, what, you know, some people say, oh, I might be too nervous to know about my risk for this. And my response is it more nervous to know about it ahead of time before you have a problem so you can make an intervention? Or is it more nervous to wait until you actually have dementia in order to figure it
right.
out?
I mean, exactly.
Nobody really wants to do that either,
right.
you know?
Right.
So,
right.
And there are certain things that we can do to try to push back on that genetic risk, you know? And I'm not saying that we can cure or reverse all kinds of diseases, but you know, if we can have you have the best quality of life that you can have, if we can delay the onset or even prevent the onset of certain conditions, then why not? I mean, you know, that's the whole concept of longevity. We want to live longer for better, you know, live longer and live better,
right.
Through our lives. And so this is where precision medicine really can help us in that. And I actually termed the coin precisionomics because that is basically the word that kind of describes using all of these kinds of concepts in order to really get to the bottom of what your health and wellness needs are for your body. Just remind me, what were some of the other questions you were asking about longevity? I mean, we can even check your telomeres. We can see how long the caps at the end of your chromosomes are and get an understanding of what your chromosomal age might be compared to what your real age is. So there are some, you know, fancy, fun things that we can do as well. And what is key and important to remember, and this is actually a slide that I put up when I give talks and presentations at various places, and that is that gut health equals DNA health, which equals whole health.
Exactly.
The concepts, very fascinatingly, are the same. Mm. So if you look at the literature on how to improve your telomere length, how to improve your longevity, how to optimize any health, heart health, brain health, whatever health, at the foundation of those recommendations lies the same concepts. And that is exercise, sleeping properly, reducing stress, eating a proper diet, social interconnections, you know, things like that, avoiding toxins. These are all the same concepts, and these are lifestyle measures. And there are actually plenty of articles and peer-reviewed literature, you know, papers that have been published on these topics and how they impact the microbiome itself. And the microbiome may actually, we may discover, be responsible in a large part to a lot of these risks that we may develop over our lives. And so, all disease begins in the gut. And perhaps the key to longevity is in the gut microbiome as well. So it's interesting how kind of, you know, my initial career choice ended up being like this, and my interest kind of developed in precision medicine and integrative health. And it all kind of comes together, you know, so it's kind of cool.
Well, and it is cool. And I got to believe that, and thank God for physicians like yourself that are having, I think it's becoming more get out, not just stay in this very, very closed, defined lane of medicine, but your training and the experience you have exposes you to so much of the science that does impact so much more of who we are holistically. And so, you know, thank God you had that revelation when you did to take this to a greater level. I would like to talk about something that I have really become fascinated with. I kind of touched on earlier, which is this idea of the gut's relationship to my neuro activity, from a performance level, from an emotional state. Talk to the listeners, because so often when we talk about gut health, first of all, you know, with the exception of guys like you, Stephen Gundry, and some of the others that are finally bringing this to the forefront, most people, they hear leaky gut and they think, what's that mean? I've got a hole in my stomach. Do I have an ulcer? You know, they don't get it. And then, so to get them from that place to understanding the connection of our gut and our mental health, energy, thought process, that's a whole nother leap to go to. So talk a little bit about the gut and its relationship to your neuroactivity, but then also feel free, please, to go into the importance of from that to mindfulness, meditation, and how the whole thing works together, because that's the stuff I'm really embracing and I love to geek out on, just because it's mind-blowing what we can do to control all of these factors. So talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, so what you're talking about is kind of this mind-gut-brain-gut connection.
Yeah.
Actually, it's calling it the brain-gut microbiome axis is probably even a little bit more specific, because that's what it is. These microbes, which are all the trillions of bacteria that live inside of our gut, do interact with our immune system and interact with our nervous system. How so? Well, you know, the gut is the digestive tract, right? And the digestive tract has its own nervous system. I don't know if too many people actually are aware of it. It's something called the enteric nervous system. And we know that there is a central nervous system, and that's what we're talking about when we're referring to our brain and our spinal cord and things like that. Mm-hmm. But when we're talking about the enteric nervous system, we're talking about the gut's nervous system. And this is where a lot of the power is probably generated in interactions with the microbes themselves. You know, the gut actually contains about 100 million neurons.
Yeah.
That's actually more than the spinal cord itself.
Crazy.
So it's definitely a formidable force and something to be aware of. And 95% of the serotonin in our body is made in the digestive tract, in the gut.
I did not know that. Okay, yeah. Awesome. So, I did not know that.
You know, and the gut actually produces all kinds of neurotransmitters. And so we're still learning about the microbiome and its interactions. So, you know, I won't pretend to say that we know everything about it, because that's just not true. But, you know, we understand that the gut may communicate with the brain through a variety of different ways. Mm-hmm. It could be through hormone pathway. It could be through neurotransmitter pathway. There could be some other chemicals or metabolites that can be released that can communicate with the brain and can actually influence things like how we feel, how well we can even think, what our cognition is. Mm-hmm. And actually vice versa also, the brain and the brain's activity can influence the gut microbiome, can even alter the composition of the microbiome.
Oh, wow.
And if you think about it from an evolutionary standpoint, this is very fascinating, right? You know, and actually from just imagine us like we're still cavemen and women or out in the jungle. This is actually a good thing, because if the brain senses that there's something there, mm-hmm. a threat, for example, mm-hmm. then it may alter our motility and our microbiome might change temporarily. That might shift in order to be ready to do something, whatever the problem might be, mm-hmm. and to react to it properly. Mm-hmm. And vice versa. If you know, you eat something or something bad is happening to you digestively, to make you aware and understand from that is also actually helpful. Is we're not kids and women, and we don't live in the jungle anymore, most of us. And modernization of food and changing the quality of food over time, and all the behaviors that we have learned and, you know, the lifestyle factors that we have kind of adapted over time have actually kind of made an imbalance in the microbiome and perhaps disrupted some of this good communication and replaced it with some bad communication. And perhaps there's a reason why there's a lot of mental health issues in people these days.
Yeah, I could not agree more. And that kind of brings me to the next thing I'd like to kind of continue on this with is, like, I have noticed that as I've become more cognitive about the relationship with the gut as well and the mind, there are certain foods that just put me in a bad mood. I mean, yeah. They just, it's crazy. I will just feel like crap, not just physically, but just mood wise. I get more tense or, you know, lethargic, whatever the case may be. Now, this is going to be kind of a, I want to ask you this. Now, this is a total layman's question, but knowing what you know, is it hard sometimes just to put certain things in your mouth? Because you know so much about what's about to happen based on a food's content. Or do you just look at people and some of the stuff that they're eating and go, hey, can I please dissuade you from eating that cupcake, please? You know, I mean, what is that like? What is it like whenever you sit down to eat a meal? What kind of calculations you're making from just a high level goofball like me making that kind of comment to truly analyzing, I'm eating this at this time of day for this reason, and this is these are the results I want to yield. And from your standpoint, how you approach it, but also that person out there that's going, all right, doctor, wow, that's a lot. I didn't realize there was that much I need to be thinking about with my meals. Simplify it so that I know what to eat, when to eat. And if you want to throw in some your take on fasting and how that relates to giving your stomach a rest and all that, take us through that little process about what do we eat, how we eat, when we eat, and how's that going to impact our mood and our mind?
Yeah, I mean, there are some basic concepts that I think are probably easier to remember. One is my mantra, fiber is good and sugar is bad. So if that's the only thing you ever remember about food, then I'm happy with that, because okay. That is actually a very key concept. fiber comes from plant foods primarily, and these are the types of foods that can feed the good microbes and help us diversify our microbiome. There's actually a concept called microbiota accessible carbohydrates. This means that these are carbohydrates. These are types of foods that are carbohydrates that are not really digested well by our own enzymes in our body that we naturally produce. And they are made, they primarily serve as food for the microbes in our colon. Mm. And so this food, as you eat it, will travel through the digestive tract. It won't be completely digested before it gets to the colon where the majority of the microbes are. It will pass through the digestive tract and then arrive at the colon where these microbes are so that they can be eaten. Okay. And so that those microbes can produce good byproducts like short chain fatty acids, for example. Short chain fatty acids are an anti-inflammatory compound that these good microbes make. So it's almost like a thank you note that they write for you after receiving a gift, the gift of food. Got it. You know, a lot of the foods that we eat are ultra processed. They have a lot of sugar content, a lot of junk, a lot of other chemicals. So what you may be feeling when you're eating these foods that are not microbiota accessible carbohydrates is that these chemicals are being absorbed in the intestinal tract, and they're going to your brain, and they're making you feel unusual, or they're creating an imbalance in the microbiome, where the microbiome is saying, oh, look at all this bad stuff. We're going to start metabolizing it. We're going to break it down. And then, you know, as a result of that, you know, when something is broken down, other chemicals are produced. And so perhaps some of those chemicals that are being released or produced in that process are actually what's giving you that mood feeling that, oh, I don't feel good when I have this, or
yeah,
I feel off when I have this. And so we want to always remember that we want to eat for our microbes. And one of the biggest problems in society these days is that a lot of the food that is available is actually not even real food. It's ultra processed foods.
Yeah.
And, you know, this isn't what we ate when we were, you know, in the jungles long ago. That's not how our body was made. You know, our body was not made to eat potato chips, as a snack. Our body was made to eat real foods because, you know, we want to be in homeostasis. We want to be in a equilibrium state. And the body was designed so that the microbiome can communicate with all the other organ systems and parts of our body so that this communication can occur and good stuff can be transferred to one place and the other place can transfer good stuff back to the other place. But if we start putting a lot of bad stuff into the mix, then everything gets messed up.
Right, right. So do you recommend fasting as a place to kind of restart and kind of take us through, if you do have a fasting protocol, what does that look like? And for someone out there that's like, this is what I run into a lot. Like, I have told people when they ask me, and I'm not an expert and I certainly don't try to give nutritional advice or anything like that. I just tell them, well, here's what I do and here are the things that have worked for me. And one of the greatest gifts I've given myself of the last probably 2 to 3 years is adopting the habit of intermittent fasting. It just makes me feel better. My energy levels are better. Lots of benefits. You talk to people and they go, there's no way I could go 16 hours without eating. And I'm like, well, look at how much you sleep. And we're not talking about, 16 hours is like on the short end of the stick, by the way. What are the benefits of fasting and what protocol do you actually follow if you do? And what's a good way to get people, if not from a tactical standpoint, here's how you start, but the message of here's why you should start. Talk to us a little bit about intermittent fasting.
Well, fasting is a hot topic these days, but fasting is not a new topic. Fasting has been around for centuries, you know. Yeah. And I think they even say the ancient pharaohs used to fast before big decisions needed to be made, or if they were in the middle of war, so that they feel that they could concentrate better and that they would be more focused. Yep. These concepts are not brand new. And even Hippocrates, the father of medicine, said long ago that fasting may have a role in helping people with certain illnesses. And he may not have known everything, like I have said in other interviews before, but you know, I would love to meet Hippocrates because his brain must be fascinating to understand how he thought about some of these things. Fasting is also a challenging topic because food and our relationship to food is a challenging topic. And there are a lot of different styles of fasting. Sometimes it may be something that, you know, you may want to feel what style fits for you best. You know, your body is the best doctor. I always tell people, don't listen to what somebody said on a podcast or on a blog or in an article. You know, you can understand the science behind the things and see how your body reacts because we're all different.
Yep.
One of the easiest ways or simplest ways, without bringing too much complication into the mix, to start fasting is intermittent fasting, time-restricted intermittent fasting. And for people who are novices at it, who are interested in learning how it makes them feel, I usually tell them to go real easy in the beginning, 12 on and 12 off. I mean, that's like saying you eat from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. If you feel like you have to eat outside that window, then we probably have to have another kind of conversation because that's a fair window. You know, it's a morning to night.
Right.
And then once you get used to that, then we can start tightening up that window as we go along. And really, you know, if you start inching and closing that window little by little, it will become, you won't even be thinking, you won't even feel the difference. It'll just be something that you do. And I really actually, I should have started with this. I don't like the word intermittent fasting. I like to call it intermittent eating because it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's just you're changing the connotation around it.
Yep.
It's like if you tell somebody no or you can't do this, they're, you know, how do you feel? You're automatically maybe on the defense. It's like, what do you mean? No, I can't eat. I can't do this. I want to eat. I'm going to eat.
Right.
So, you know, if you say it's intermittent eating, it really changes the context around it mentally, I guess. And that might help people who have, you know, issues with, you know, how they eat and things like that. I think a good place to settle on is 8 hours of eating and 16 hours of fasting. And that's more like a 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. type thing. If you want to, pick a window of time. It doesn't have to be that exact window of time, but you know, that basically means that you wake up and the first thing you're doing is not eating. You eat a little bit later, give your body a chance to wake up and digestion and the gut to start working. And then you eat and then, you know, have a early dinner, basically, I guess like 5 o'clock or so, and which is not unreasonable. And then you don't eat. Right. And what it does at a minimum, at the most basic level, is basically stop you or deter you from eating junk and snacks later in the day, which is really probably the Achilles heel for a lot of people. They may eat good during the day, or they may eat salads and healthy foods during the day, but then it's that nighttime that kind of gets them. That's that bowl of cereal or bowl of ice cream or chips or nachos or cured meats or whatever, you know, cheese that really gets you at the end of the day. And oftentimes, you know, it's coupled together with watching TV or watching a movie or socializing or alcohol. And so you do all this good during the day and then you just kind of pee on it at the end of the day. Yeah. You ruin it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. So
time restricted eating is one way of basically disciplining ourselves, I guess, if you want to put it that way. And forcing us to try to let our bodies rest, which is what we want to do. I mean, if you think about how were we ages and ages ago, you know, our ancestors weren't eating all day long. They didn't even have the food to eat all day long. That wasn't even how it was done, you know?
Yep.
And so our bodies evolved in a particular way. And with our modern way of living, that kind of fell to the wayside a bit. And I think that's why it's important to kind of remember the basics, remember who we are, what we are, and where we came from, and try to eat and behave in that way.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you too, as it relates to that eating window, going back to the fiber question, no sugar, eat fiber. What sources of fiber, what should we be eating to get that fiber content?
And that's a good question. And then I also wanted to make sure we said that it should be a wide variety of fiber sources.
Okay.
That's a key concept also. And fiber primarily is in plant foods, so vegetables and fruits.
Okay.
And we want to eat a wide variety of these kinds of vegetables and fruits, because as we were talking about microbiota accessible carbohydrates, different microbiota, different microbes, different bacteria thrive on different kinds of fibers. And so if you say, okay, I heard him, he said plants have fiber and broccoli is my favorite vegetable, so I'm gonna eat broccoli all day long because that's a microbiome diet for me. No, that's not gonna do it. You're gonna basically be cultivating an environment where broccoli eating bacteria are thriving, but everybody else may be suffering as a result.
Right.
And so we don't yet have the ability to sequence the microbiome and understand which types of foods good populations of bacteria that are in your gut thrive on yet. I mean, and what those bacteria do as a result of, a lot of different things in our bodies. We understand a lot of things about the microbiome, but we are not at that level yet where we could do a simple test and it can tell us that you have these microbes and these are the good ones that are in small populations that you want to cultivate the growth of. These are the ones that are doing well, so you should eat this food and that food. We're not there yet, but I don't think it's going to be too far along before we actually have, you know, legitimate testing that can help us in that regard. So what we say now is eat the rainbow. And this is part of where, you know, this concept comes from. Other people may say eat the rainbow for various different reasons. I say eat the rainbow because that's what the gut wants. The gut wants you to have a lot of colorful fruits and vegetables, different kinds, switch it up. the color in the foods actually are these polyphenols. These are these good chemicals that come from the plants that actually also help the microbiome and help cultivate diversity and strength in the microbiome as well. And if we eat a lot of different kinds of vegetables and fruits and we switch it up all the time, then we are trying to please the crowd as best as we can. Giving this guy his food. We're giving this gal his food. We're giving these groups of people their food. And everybody is well fed and everybody is happy and everybody is growing. And you have a nice and thriving community or ecosystem. And so that's the main concept when it comes to fiber and food choices.
What about supplementation? I'm an Athletic Greens guy. I usually have a scoop of Athletic Greens every day in my protein shake, which also has some four sigmatic, you know, some mushroom, some lion's mane. Is that a good strategy to make sure that you're getting the diversity in there?
It's not a bad idea. You know, when it comes to these powders, though, you want to make sure you check the labels and see what else is in the powders, because it's not going to be straight up vegetables. There may be other things in there that might be a problem. There may even be a sweetener in there that could be a FODMAP sugar, for example, like xylitol or mannitol. And you're taking the powder, for example, to help serve the purpose that you're talking about. But at the same time, you are creating digestive distress, perhaps, because of something else that's inside. So that's important. The other thing that I like doing, which is even better, might be to make a nice smoothie.
Yeah.
In a smoothie, you can put all kinds of stuff, and it may not even taste like that food if you ate it individually. So particularly with kids, you know, it's a good way to sneak in some beets and spinach and kale and things like that, that they may say, oh, what is this? I don't want to eat this, you know,
right.
Especially
right.
Little kids, and mix it in with, you know, blueberries and raspberries. That might kind of cover up the taste a little bit and sweeten it up naturally without having to add, you know, sugar to it, and put in some flax and chia, you know. So there are various ways that you can actually do this on your own pretty quickly, you know, at home.
Yeah, no, to the listener, let me just reinforce that. I am a huge smoothie guy, man. I go crazy. Dr. Singh, it's like this just menagerie of whatever I can get my hands on. And to your point, you know, to thicken it up, like frozen spinach along with some fresh spinach. For anybody out there that's listening that hates spinach, you're not going to taste it. You're just not, especially if you put other good stuff with it. I do want to ask you about this, though. So plant-based protein powders or just do I even, because I'm kind of getting, I don't know, not jaded, but I'm just starting to think that all protein powder is bad, and maybe that's right or maybe it's wrong. I don't know. What are your thoughts on protein powders? I know whey is like it's a little harder on your digestive system, right? So I've kind of moved away from that to try to find better plant-based protein powders. Are those okay or should I avoid them?
I think, you know, if you have a hard time trying to get in the proper amount of nutrients that you might need on a daily basis, and it's a good, clean product with organic stuff and minimally processed, then, okay, you know, you can use it as a supplement, but nothing should really replace the real thing, which is real food. And remember the rule of thumb, if it was made in a bag or a box, it's processed. Yeah. By definition, it's processed.
Yeah.
And if it's processed, you know, not every company is the same. So you want to look into the philosophy of the company and what they do and how they make their foods. But if it's processed, it's something that's made for profit, right? It's a business.
Yeah.
If it's made for profit, then their interest may not necessarily be in your health.
Mm-hmm.
The interest is in their income.
Right.
That's the business. That's just how the world works. And so, you know, don't necessarily always think that this is a product on the shelf and it's in the health aisle, therefore it is translates to good for my health. It may not always be the case.
Right.
There are some companies who are doing a great job at reducing the amount of processing needed and trying to give very clean, simple products. And you want to kind of look into those kinds of things if you have the ability to.
Okay. All right. So take me through a day in the life of Dr. Marvin Singh from your, you know, headspace, whatever you're doing for your mindfulness. What are you going to eat? What is that feeding window going to look like? What are the things that you're going to try to make sure you do not do, that do not sleep into your day? What does the day look like? What's your protocol?
Man, my day is probably not a typical day that you would compare to anybody else on the planet, probably.
I would imagine that's probably the case. What you got, man?
Today, I woke up a little bit earlier than usual so that we can do this show. So this may not be a typical morning. It was 5:30 or 5 o'clock this morning when I woke up a.m. on the Pacific coast to get ready for today. But generally, you know, I will wake up in the morning and first thing I do is drink a tall glass of water. I mean, we've been essentially fasting overnight and hydration levels may be a little bit lower. So I drink water and I'm a coffee guy, you know, it's one of my habits. You know, you saw me drinking coffee earlier today. I generally try to drink the coffee black. Espresso is my favorite. While the coffee is being made, I will set up my little quiet space and I usually do some breath work in the morning. And
what is what is that protocol? Are you doing box breathing? What is your breath work look like?
My favorite is 4-7-8 breath. Okay. It's very easy. It's the first breath that I learned, and you know, Andrew Weil taught it to me. And so I guess I have some connection to it, and I find it very helpful. Okay. And so I'll do the 4-7-8 breath for a few minutes, and then I will kind of just transition into kind of a meditative state. Sometimes I may have some, you know, binaural beats or calming music in the background. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it kind of depends on maybe what mood I'm in. Or maybe I'll have a guided meditation and I'll do the breath work at the end of the meditation. You know, I switch it up sometimes. You know, I guess it's good to do different things, different styles, so, you know, it doesn't get boring to you. Yeah. I generally don't eat breakfast in the morning. I generally am one of those fasting guys. You know, if you're drinking black coffee or tea, you know, you can still maintain that that idea of fasting. Yep. You're not eating the calories and stuff and changing the dynamic by doing that. And then it really depends from there what I do next. You know, I get ready to go to work. Either I'm doing telemedicine from home or going to see patients in practice or doing endoscopy. Which is what I'm doing today. So after we're done here, I have colonoscopies and endoscopies to do. I wear many different hats. So
yeah,
I do precision medicine and integrative health, but I still do the general GI stuff too.
Yeah.
Then, you know, I'll go through the whole work day. In the middle of the day, lunchtime, you know, I will break fast. And generally lunch is a big salad. That's kind of what we've done. And my wife is nice and helps me out with that and helps get it ready for me so that I can take it to work.
Tell me what's in it, because I'm always looking for a good salad. And I get in a rut. My wife gets upset with me because she gets sick of my tons of spinach or a spring mix and berries. And then I'll make some homemade like kind of vinaigrette with like a little bit of sweet to it. She gets sick of that. So I need some ideas. What's a good power salad?
It is a good idea to switch it up a little bit. You know, my wife is the big chef. Sometimes we switch it up. Some of the main ingredients, you know, I like romaine for the crunch.
Yeah.
Definitely spinach is always in there. Sometimes she'll throw in some kale. Cilantro I've been liking lately, kind of
really
cilantro, you know, switches that gives you a little different flavor, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
And we've been liking a lot of arugula these days too. Arugula gives it a little bit of a bite, kind of
changes the
taste of it.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes you put something in, sometimes you put something else in, kind of, you know, mix it up a little bit. So you got a bunch of different greens in there. That's really the base of the salad. And I love tomatoes, so she'll usually put tomatoes in there and cucumbers and carrots and celery. I'm not much of a fruit in the salad guy. I mean, I'll eat it, but you know, fruit in the salad is maybe a periodic thing. It's
got it.
That's not for me as much on the regular basis.
Right. What's your dressing look like?
Yeah. So the dressing, before we get to the dressing, we'll also put hemp seeds. So I like a little bit of a nutty flavor undertone.
Yeah.
And usually, you know, there'll be either walnuts or pecans or, you know, pine nuts, yep. something, you know, extra like that on top of there.
Some good fats.
To add some extra to it. I love avocados. And but, you know, my younger son has an allergy to avocados, so we don't eat it in the house very much. So whenever I'm out and I'm getting a salad, I'll always put avocado in it because that's when I get my avocado.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm with you.
And then so dressing, very simple, you know, or organic olive oil and balsamic, you know, equal, you know, put proportions in. Usually we'll have a little glass jar container that, because if I'm going to take it to work, and you know, you just shake it up and you just pour it on top.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing too, that I don't think a lot of people realize, like when they, the crap that is in store-bought dressings. Oh my gosh. Until I started making homemade dressings, which like you said, are pretty simple, you know, I was just amazed at, and it really spoils you. You'll never want to go back to the store-bought garbage.
I've had people say, oh yeah, I eat a salad every day, you know? And so what dressing do you put? They say Thousand Island is my favorite. Oh my God. You're eating the salad. Well, just eat a donut. I mean,
exactly. 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 All right. So you've made it through lunch. You've had a big salad. If I want you to touch on this too. I mean, cause like you getting up early to do this podcast in the middle of the whirlwind of other projects you have going on. How do you stay disciplined and protect your time throughout the day? So, okay, we go through lunch and then kind of touch on that, how you're like, okay, I've got to stay focused and keep my mind right through getting all of these things done.
From a technical standpoint, Google Calendar is my best friend.
Okay. All right. All right.
Without the Google Calendar, I'm totally screwed. I won't know where I'm supposed to be. But all kidding aside, you know, around lunchtime is a time to, I really try to protect my lunch hour because that's a time where you can kind of refocus yourself. You know, take a few deep breaths, have a nourishing lunch. I try to, as much as possible, if I can, depending on what the timetable is like, go for a little walk even if I'm doing telemedicine from home. I try to, you know, I've been known to go out in the backyard with the kids and throw the ball around or go on the swing set with them or just do something to kind of detach from that morning and be ready for the second part of the day and whatever that second part of the day may hold. You know, obviously today I won't be able to do that because I'm not going to be home. I'm going to be, you know, doing colonoscopies. But in between cases, I've been known, you can ask the nurses in my center, that in between cases, if there's a little bit of a lull or we're waiting for somebody to arrive, or it's lunchtime and we're not ready for the next case, I'll be doing laps around the building. I just walk around the building, you know, that Smart. Way I'm not too far from work. And I can come in at any moment. If somebody arrived, I can come right in. But I'm at least keeping myself busy, and, doing something good for my health. And so, so that's how the middle of the day goes. And middle of the day is also another good time to remember about hydration. We want to always be drinking water too. And it's also a good time for tea. So, you know, green tea, oolong tea, these may give you a little bit of a boost, but not too much, and provide some very healthy chemicals for your body as well, because these are anti-inflammatory teas that not only taste good, but are good for your health as well. And then we go through the second part of the day, the afternoon, and once that's done, ready to be home with the family and help with the dinner process. And I don't stop working at 5 o'clock like many people might. There's actually probably a third part to my day, but I'm a little bit of an anomaly, I guess, because it's hard to arrange all these podcasts and write books and give presentations if you don't have time to do that. So I'll spend a few hours in the evening doing that kind of stuff as well. And then I have a hard stop. I wind down, you know, and hang out with the family, and you know, all the usual end of the day processes happen. And I will try to do some breath work at the end of the day, just to kind of close the day off and kind of set the intention for the next morning. And then we go to sleep, and I try to shoot for around 7 hours of sleep a day. It's kind of what is probably the magic number. Everybody's a little bit different in what their actual needs are, but there was even a study a few years back from the Journal of the American Heart Association suggesting that the sweet spot might be around 7 hours of sleep a night for a reduction of all-cause mortality and cardiovascular risks. So, so we try to do that, and then that's it. The day's over.
You know, you mentioned two things there that are so simple that I have just recently given myself permission for one thing, and an understanding of is one, walking, like, and realizing that just because you don't have a scheduled time, like in the day, that is to, I don't go to gyms. I do all my working out here. I have a gym at the house that I don't want to be around people, but for that, just generically speaking, if you're just because you're not going to the gym or just because you don't have that hour, there are other physical things you can do, like the walking, and then two, sleep. You know, that's one of the things I'm really trying to work on is my evening protocol, because everyone's so focused on up early, I shower, meditation. The morning is kind of this magical thing, and it is, it's so important. I mean, I have a very disciplined routine, but that, what you just said, having that evening wind down, because walking and sleep, as you know, as a physician, and just what I as a layperson have realized, so much research is showing that those are two of the most powerful indicators of wellness as to whether or not you're going to be, is a good sleep and just walking, moving.
Yeah. And I should say, I mean, if the afternoon, if the lunchtime physical activity didn't happen, then, you know, I try to shift things around towards the evening after the day is over. I like to do that kind of stuff before I eat dinner. So, you know, if I finish, you know, work around 5 o'clock, I might, you know, hop on the Peloton or go for a walk with the kids, or even run around with the kids, do some weights or something like that, you know, just so that I get that physical activity. And it's physical activity that we want.
Yeah.
It's not so much to be focused on, it has to be this kind of exercise or it's not going to be useful. I think maybe sometimes people get, you know, stuck on that concept. Well, I don't have time to go to the gym, like they say, you know, I don't have time to do this or that, so I'm just going to do nothing. Well, just because you don't have the time to do that doesn't mean you just do nothing. You do something. Even walking is exercise. We want to move. Really, the idea should be movement rather than exercise. This is kind of like how you frame it in your mind. Like we were saying, intermittent eating instead of intermittent fasting. Instead of exercise, call it movement.
Right, right. All right, so you hit one of my hot buttons. I'm a Peloton freak, dude. I mean, I am like, let me tell you something. If they ever have a Pelo Olympics, I'm going to crush it. I mean, I'm like up there. Matt Wilpers and I know Matt now. So what's your leaderboard name? I got to find you.
I don't know if I'll tell you offline.
Perfect. Oh, yeah, because, oh, that's right. Yeah, you get everybody trying to ride with. I want to know, man. We got to ride together. That has become my wife. I think she thought she'd given me the greatest gift in the world until she realized that now I have a mistress and her name is Peloton. But I've gotten a little better, but I ride pretty much every day. I lead the Power Zone challenges and all that stuff, man. So I'm excited about that, man. We'll definitely ride together. So with you doing all the writing, the speaking, the podcast, and you are so prolific in your content creation, as you can tell, these are just the books that I have lined up that are like on my reading list. I try to read at a minimum a book a week. What do you read? But fiction for anything. What do you like to feed the mind with?
So as you could see in my usual day, there's not a lot of time to actually sit and read outside of, you know, I will read during the day, like there may be articles and stuff in between patients, or if there's something pertinent to a patient, I'll be reading then. And that's kind of how a doctor reads, you know, stuff usually, like in between stuff like that. But I take advantage of my car rides. So I'm a big audiobook guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I may have the physical book itself. So if I want to dive a little bit deeper or double check one part, I have the actual book, depending on the book, if it's good enough to buy it twice.
But gotcha.
But for the most part, you know, I drive a lot as I have a commute on certain days, and I just pop in a book. I mean, I learned that habit from a very early stage. And when I started integrative medicine training, I think, you know, I did the whole 2-year fellowship, but during that 2 years, I also read 80 books. You know, I went through 80 books, and that's really what kind of helped propel me into the field, because I learned a lot about a lot of different things. I didn't just read health books. I read about quantum theory. I read about, you know, all kinds of stuff, because it just helped me understand the nature of who we are as humans and how the world works. So reading is very, very important. It's a good tool.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I always say it's like push-ups for your brain. And I know that I wish that I had adopted it at a younger age. You know, it has had one of the most, has a calming effect. It makes me just think better. It has been one of the best parts of my routine. All right, so before I let you go, let people know where they can find out more about you and the work that you're doing, because I do think the work that you're performing, your practice, is so important. So where can people find you and learn more?
Well, I'm easily accessible on social media. So my Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook are at Dr. Marvin Singh. And my website is precisionclinic.com. So PRECISIONE, precision with an E, precisionclinic.com. I spelled it wrong on purpose. That's actually the Italian way of spelling precision. The reason is because the E allows us to make the end of the word O-N-E, so one. So really kind of underscores, it's a little play on words, to underscore the importance of each individual and understanding what's going on inside of each person's body.
Well, Dr. Singh, I can tell you that this has been a joy for me. I am so honored and thankful that you would take this time to look, I know whenever I get a guest like you that I could just sit here with all day and just wear you out with questions, I fire a lot. And so thank you for being accommodating to my kind of monkey mind jumping around, and for being here for my audience. And thank you for the work you're doing. This has been an absolute pleasure, brother. Thank you so much.
No problem. I had a great time chatting with you.
Well, folks, that does it for this episode of the Jason Wright Podcast. Thanks so much for joining. Today, I'm going to change it up a little bit. I'm going to do an outro with one of the coolest songs that I have discovered in a while from one of my favorite bands, the Black Crowes. In an effort to improve always and always, one of those things I'm always wanting to improve is my mood, and this song just always puts me in a good mood. It's called Soul Singing. It's the one I mentioned in the Vitruvian Letter, which if you have not subscribed to, I hope you will. That is where I document and compile all the different things that I'm doing to try to improve always and always. You can do that by going to jasonwrightnow.com, and I really hope you will. But with that, just sit back, chill out, feel free to sing at the top of your lungs. You'll probably want to dance. That's what this song does to me, which looks awful because I am a horrific dancer. But nevertheless, it's a lot of fun. So with that, until we meet again, keep endeavoring to improve always and always. And as always, I am so grateful for you spending this time with me. Thanks.
Been down, cascading in blue without a sound. Now I've traded my black feathers for a crown. So feed me milk and honey, lay me down, lay me down. Look around, show me holy places not yet found. Let's disappear and we'll hide underground. And we'll get high and we'll feel safe and sound. It comes around, right, yeah, 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 yeah. upside down.